Hello and welcome to the Choralosophy Podcast. I'm Chris Muntz. I'm the host of the show, and this is episode 33, Risk Assessment for Group Activities with Dr. Amish Adalja. I am over the moon to be able to send you this episode and this information today in a time when our entire profession, and this is in the music education profession, and I'm sure our colleagues in other areas of school work with large groups of kids are also reeling right now with the possibility that even though lockdowns are ending, and even though on the news we're hearing things that are reopening and coming back to whatever the new normal is, that might not apply to those of us who work with students in groups, that when school starts back up again, we might not have those groups anymore in the way that we're used to. And that's really hard to hear. That's really hard to wrap our minds around. And my goal with this episode is to try to fill in some of the gaps so that we can use our educated minds as professionals to advocate for ourselves in the best possible way, and more importantly, so that we can advocate for our students and the experiences that we believe so strongly that they deserve. Now, I fully understand that a lot of these decisions will be out of our hands. They won't be things that we can make at our pay grade of whether or not certain events in our district or at our university or in our church will be allowed. But why this does matter, it does matter for us to be educated as much as we possibly can, so that if there is an instance where we need to be careful with something, we have done so based on data and information that we can hold in the palm of our hand and point to defend ourselves if we make a decision. That's important. But we also need, if we're going to go ahead with an activity at some point, because we're going to have to, right? If we want to have a profession, if we want there to be choral music ever again, at some point, at a point in the future, where the risk won't be zero, but we're going to have to decide to have the rehearsal anyway. And we're going to have to decide to have the concert anyway, because as you will hear on this episode, Dr. Adalja points out, as many of the experts have from the very beginning, there is not going to be a point now, ever, where the coronavirus is not around. The risk, vaccines don't work for everyone. We can bring the risk down quite a bit at certain points in the near future, but we can't ever get it to be zero. All of that being said, if the risk is never going to be zero, and we want to have choir again at some point, or sports, or band and orchestra, we're going to have to know how to justify that decision and how to even calculate in an educated manner in our local areas. And if you're pulled into a meeting with administrators to talk about these things, how do you have the conversation about risk assessment? Is it an acceptable risk in our area? Is it not an acceptable risk in our area? Those are going to be the hard, unbelievably hard questions we're going to have to ask and have to answer. There will be situations where many of us are in decision-making bodies in our school districts where we will be held accountable for these decisions. So the goal of this thought exercise today is to listen to Dr. Adalja and maybe learn something that you didn't already know about the ways that you can process through the risk in your area. And that's going to be one of the big important points that you'll hear throughout. The risk will not be the same everywhere. And so even though we in the choral profession are all in this together, air quotes, we might be in a situation in the very near future where choir is deemed safe in some places and not others. And my challenge to us as a profession is that if we're in an area where it's not safe because of the risk assessment is too high, we are cheering on our brothers and sisters in other parts of the country who are able to have their ensembles. Can we lift them up, make them our standard bearers, or will we react with shaming and jealousy? That's going to be my challenge, because it's going to happen. There will be places that have choir while other places don't. And as you will hear from this upcoming episode, that's going to probably be our new normal, or part of it, in all types of activities. Is some people will get to do things and other people won't, and that's going to be really hard. Before we get to Dr. Adalja, I'm going to point out one sponsor for this show that I haven't talked about in a little while, just because we've been in distance learning mode. But now as we start to imagine online things that we're going to have to do possibly more often and longer term, I'm going to point you back towards vocevista.com. Voce Vista is a software that you can download that when you can't have, this is a really cool feature that I never thought about using until I was not in the room with my students, is, you know, you're doing your voice lesson through Zoom, right? Well, you can't hear them very well. You can't hear the resonance in any kind of real way. Well, with Voce Vista, let's say you've got several lessons under your belt with Zoom, and maybe you need some really good concrete way to develop an evaluation for that student where you can truly hear and analyze the way they're singing at a minute level. Maybe once a month, they send you a recording. Well, you can plug that recording into Voce Vista, and you can see and then show them back the recording that they've turned in, whether or not it's rich in overtones, whether or not the vowels were formed correctly, whether or not there is a singer's formant happening, which I know that when I'm doing my lessons, it's really hard to tell if there's a singer's formant happening because the iPhone microphones start going as soon as the singer sings with enough resonance to actually create a formant, right? So this Voce Vista tool is an excellent one in this distance learning environment. So I'd encourage you to head over to vocevista.com/choralosophy and download it for free. And then you play with it for 30 days and decide if you like it. And then if you decide to go ahead and buy the $99 software, you can use that Choralosophy podcast code, just Choralosophy at checkout, and get 10% off. And then you own it. And it's an amazing tool. And I'm going to start using that if I have to continue my online voice lessons. So I strongly encourage you to check that out. Okay, here we go. Without any further ado, I bring you Dr. Amish Adalja of Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Amish. Okay, so Dr. Amish Adalja, thank you so much for coming on the show. I've got a panicked education profession out there, and I've asked you on the show really for the goal of just helping us learn some things that we might not have otherwise learned. So could you first start out by introducing yourself to my audience who might not know who you are?
So my name is Amish Adalja. I'm a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security and an infectious disease physician. The Center for Health Security is a think tank that focused on infectious disease emergency, pandemic preparedness, bioterrorism preparedness, anything that really has to do with the intersection of infectious disease and national security. And I also see patients. Most of my work has been trying to understand pandemics, trying to predict them, trying to think about what policies and programs need to be in place to minimize their impact.
Okay, that's great. So I want to start off, if it's okay, with some virus basics that lay people might not understand. I actually came across you for the first time back in March when you were on Sam Harris's podcast. And one of the things that I found very helpful to have explained to me was the concept that viral spread, the R-naught number, is not an inherent feature of a virus itself, but it's something that changes from place to place. Is that accurate?
Right. R-naught is not something that's intrinsic to a pathogen. It really has to do with who the pathogen is infecting and the circumstances. So when you hear about an R-naught or a reproduction number, it's really just an average. And you can have a person can be infected with the novel coronavirus with any infection and not infect anybody else. So their R-naught is basically zero. And then you can have a Typhoid Mary situation where the R-naught is much higher. And what it's important to know is when you think about the R-naught, it's better just to think about it in buckets. There are things that are not transmissible between humans, like tetanus, for example. So there, the R-naught is zero. Then there are things that are highly transmissible that are spread through the airborne route. So measles, for example, that's like an R-naught of 18 or so. And then it kind of this intermediate level of R-naughts, which range from about 2 to 5 or 6. And that's where you find all of our respiratory viruses, things like influenza and this coronavirus. So I don't get too hung up on knowing what the exact number is. Is it 2.8 or is it 2.6 or what it might be? Just knowing that it's a respiratory virus, it doesn't spread in the manner of measles, and it's clearly efficiently transmissible between person to person. I think that helps to understand conceptually what we mean by a reproductive number and how contagious a pathogen is.
And how does population density play into that calculation for epidemiologists?
So when you're looking at how something moves through a population, the number of contacts a person may have in their day-to-day life is going to influence how much opportunity a pathogen has to pass from one person to another. So if you're in a very population dense person where you can't basically leave your residence without running into people in the elevator, in the stairs, on public transportation, whatever you're carrying is going to have a much easier chance of jumping from you to another person than if you're somebody who lives in a rural area by yourself. You get out, you get in your car, you drive to the place where you work, and maybe there's only three other people at your work site because you're doing some kind of construction or something. That's not going to be very conducive to the spread. So population density is definitely a magnifier of this virus. And we've seen the fact that New York City was such a hotspot has to be interpreted in light of the population density that New York City has compared to other cities in the United States.
So it would not be true then to think that in general that a person could leave New York carrying the virus and bring the New York situation to Wyoming.
No, they could bring the virus there and they could cause infections and they could cause disruption, but it wouldn't spread in the same manner because of the population density. So we're very worried about what we call megacities. And New York City is the closest thing we have to a megacity in the United States. If you think about places like Lagos in Nigeria or Mumbai in India or Beijing or Shanghai, many of these places are really dangerous when you have an infectious disease spreading because of the population density. That doesn't mean to minimize the risk that a rural area might have, because we have seen rural areas get hit with this and disrupt their hospital systems and lead to death. And we're seeing that right now in meatpacking plants in some rural areas. And that also might have to do with the population density in these congregate workplaces. But it is true that the population density is a magnifier of the impact of an infection. And that may be why things that happened in New York City weren't completely extrapolable to other parts of the country. Although it is at the same time true that all parts of the country need to prepare for this virus and need to be able to make sure that they can handle whatever number of cases they have, even with the benefits they might have with a lower population density.
Right. So we have to, no matter where we are, we have to be prepared to think about how the virus might affect our area within its scale. So if a rural area might have way less hospital beds, which could cause a problem if the virus were to get bad there. Is that a fair characterization?
Exactly. There are rural areas that do not have the advantages of having major academic medical centers with excess bed capacity or the ability to augment capacity. They also may not have access to the same specialists like infectious disease specialists or critical care medicine specialists. So in some ways, they may be better off because of their population density and the natural social distancing that lends itself to, but they may be worse off in terms of hospital capacity and medical expertise.
That's great. And that was confusing to me at first because I was hearing a lot on the news and as people, of course, I'm sure you're aware that Facebook book is full of a bunch of epidemiology experts now. I don't know if you had that much competition before. but one of the things that I would hear early on was that, don't feel safe in the rural areas because you're just behind the curve. What's happening in New York is going to be happening to you next. And so it sounds like what you're saying is that that's true in one sense, but false in another sense.
Exactly. These aren't like synchronous outbreaks that are going to occur identically in every place. Each place is going to have its own dynamics that are a function not only of the virus, but of what the people do in that area, what the medical resources are there, how well resourced the health department might be in that area, as well as what the demographics are. Is it an older population? Is it a younger population? All of that is going to play a role in how each community faces this virus. But what is true is that every community will face this virus, and it's going to be different, and there are going to be different challenges there, and not everything can be extrapolated from one location to another. And it's important to recognize that. And that's why many of these decisions have to be made at the state or a regional level rather than a one-size-fits-all type of decision for this country.
It's a wonderful segue that you just did. That was going to be my next question, actually, was how you felt about the idea then, based on that information, that decisions about which, of course, we're heading into reopening in a lot of different places around the country now. And as we make decisions about what types of activities and public functions should be allowed, should we be making the decisions at the most local possible level based on all of these varying factors?
I would say it should be at least at a regional level. you run the risk if it's local and it's at, for example, a municipal level, you might have people spilling into another municipality and causing a problem. So you want it to have some kind of a buffer. So I think regional is the best way to do that. And regional might mean county in some places. It might mean multiple counties in another place. And it might be coordination between states in other situations. So for example, if you look at the New York City metro area, that involves New York State, New Jersey, and Connecticut. So that needs to be coordinated, at least in that part of the area where there is a lot of travel between the three places. So I do think in general, though, when you are making these decisions, you have to look at the dynamics in the region you're talking about, the hospital capacity in the region you're talking about, the diagnostic testing access, as well as how well-resourced the health department is. Because as we move forward, it is without a doubt we're going to get more cases and more deaths. The key will be keeping that rate at a level that's manageable by the hospital system. That's what social distancing is about, is trying to preserve hospital capacity. So we want to make sure that when we do get these cases, that we're able to diagnose them, that we're able to contact trace them, and we're able to take care of them in our hospitals. That's the way we kind of move forward, because the virus isn't going anywhere. This is something now that is basically endemic in the human population. So now we have to come forward with a path that we all take going forward, looking at this as a risk that everybody's going to have to take and trying to manage that risk as best we can without causing our hospitals to go into crisis mode.
So I feel like I've listened to enough of you talk about this that some of these things are things that I've heard and heard discussed. But so it sounds like what you're saying is that the lockdowns were never going to help us get rid of the virus. They weren't going to help us kick it to the dustbin of history. They were simply to spread out how many people were getting sick all at once. Is that accurate?
Exactly. Exactly. Flattening the curve isn't.
You know, go ahead.
Flattening the curve was about preventing excess deaths and preserving hospital capacity. And it may be that we have the exact same area under the curve with the shutdowns as we would have had otherwise, but the peak is not as much of a spike and much more rolling, never exceeding hospital capacity. And that was the goal, because we knew that this is a virus that spreads efficiently from person to person. That, by definition, is really not a containable virus, that this was going to establish itself in the human population. And the goal was really basically to push reset and get to a point where the number of cases and the number of hospitalizations was manageable by the healthcare system. It was not to eradicate this virus. This virus is not going to be eradicated in the absence of a vaccine. That's really important to know, is that this isn't something like Ebola that has inefficiencies in transmission. This transmits efficiently. This is something that is here to stay until we have a vaccine. So we have to find a way to manage our lives in the midst of this pandemic, in the midst of this virus. And that's going to be different for each person, because it has to do with risk tolerance. And the metric that I use, the one that I think is important, is making sure that our hospitals are adequately able to care for the number of patients that we get without going into crisis. And that's why some of those shutdowns that occurred in places like New York City and New Orleans, where hospitals were very close to the brink there, were necessary. But as we move forward, hospital capacity has been augmented, but we have to keep an eye on it to make sure we never get into a point where that's threatened again. And that's how we kind of move forward until we have a vaccine.
Yes, absolutely. That seems to make a lot of sense to me, and it seems intuitive. I appreciate that explanation. One other question that I had about the kind of the structure of the virus overall. I heard you back in March make a prediction that when more and more data was coming in on this, that we would start to see a mortality rate somewhere at the high end of 0.6%, which I understood you to mean that as more of an infection fatality rate rather than a case fatality rate. Is that a fair characterization?
Yes. Of the people who are infected with this virus, I think approximately 0.5, 0.6 at a high end are likely to die from it.
Okay. So some of the initial models that were used back in early March to justify some of the lockdown strategies, am I correct in saying that they used a fatality rate that is much higher than that?
They did use a higher fatality rate, and they also used a higher hospitalization rate than what we found to be true. And I don't fault them for that, because there was a very major deficiency of information at that time, and we knew that there was a severity bias, and modelers do present different scenarios with different types of assumptions. And it's up to the policymakers to look at those models and decide which way they want to go. So I don't completely fault the modelers, but as we get more information from reality, because remember, models are a reflection or a representation of reality. They're not a substitute for reality, and they're not oracles. We have to refine models based on real data that we're getting. And we're seeing that the hospitalization rate is not probably 20%, but closer to maybe 5% in most places. And that really does impact how you think about hospital capacity, which again is the rationale for the social distancing. And this is something that happens in outbreak after outbreak. If you remember back in Ebola, there were models that had talked about death rates that were really astronomical, that really were just more of thought experiments. So it's important that we look at models as tools and realize that every model is going to be wrong, but some may provide useful information to help guide our decisions. But in the end, they're not going to be a substitute for reality.
Yeah, that makes total sense. I had that same thought, that I don't fault the modelers for being wrong. I'm not. I went to graduate school and had to do some modeling, but I'm not a scientist. I'm an artist. But that seemed intuitive to me that they would guess based on information that they don't yet have. But they're going to make a guess, and they're probably going to be wrong. My question though is, in your opinion, because you deal a lot with policy and public policy related to these things as well, is now that we're starting to know more of the data that comes in, that is starting to bring that death rate, that infection fatality rate closer to what you had predicted earlier on, should we be adjusting our response to what we determine as safe or not safe, factoring in that new information? Kind of a Bayesian concept.
I do think that individual risk perception should change based on the data that comes from actual experience with the virus. And I do think you're seeing that people are starting to understand that this, although that this is bad, it's very serious, it's going to be the most challenging infectious disease emergency we've dealt with in over 100 years, it is not apocalyptic. And that it is something that can be managed. The real strain was trying to understand how to right-size the response so that on the one hand, you kept hospital capacity preserved, and on the other hand, you didn't disrupt life too much. And I do think as we have now kind of passed the peak in some of our hotspots, for example, New York City, New Orleans, Detroit, Chicago, you are seeing a reevaluation of what measures are impactful, which ones are not impactful, and you are seeing governors increasingly relax social distancing regulations. So long as the virus is there, however, the fact is that certain things are going to be very difficult to have, and that includes mass gatherings, like major sports events in arenas or rock concerts. Those are going to be difficult because the number of patients that could emanate from one of those events could be enough to put a hospital into crisis. So there is still going to need to be a lot of caution when you're dealing with mass gatherings in a way that we didn't have to do in November, for example. So there is going to be a new normal. Hopefully, though, we'll be able to peel back a lot of the social restrictions that are in place now, or at least modify them so that people can get back to work and get back to life. But I do think we have to be prepared to not have these mass gatherings until there is a vaccine because of the sheer danger of having such a situation boil over again.
Absolutely. That makes sense. And you're also continuing to provide excellent segues for me into my next questions. It's like we're sharing a brain here. I appreciate it. You mentioned the mass gatherings. Most of the audience that will listen to this show are educators who are looking at the possibility of new realities in the areas of larger student groups. So we have a lot of music educators that listen to this podcast. I plan on sharing this also with coaches, organizations, because I wanted to get your take on the idea that you mentioned mass gatherings. How do you define mass as being something we should be especially careful about?
There's not some special number that when you cross it, it becomes more dangerous than not. If you're at 49, it's fine. And if it's 50, you cross some kind of threshold. This is some kind of a line that you have to draw. But what I'm talking about with mass gatherings are Super Bowl, baseball, professional baseball games, those types of events where there are so many people coming from different parts of the country that you really risk the chance of transmission occurring and leading to a large number of cases that not only could overwhelm a hospital, but will clearly overwhelm the contact tracers at a health department, where they have to try and figure out how many people were at a Pittsburgh Steelers game and how many people were in contact with this person. That could be overwhelming to any health department, even the most well-resourced. But when you're talking about smaller events, I do think there's ways to have them in a safe manner. Obviously, people who are in the vulnerable populations, those who are older, those with other medical problems, are going to continue to have to really be mindful of their contacts and try and be as best with social distancing as they can be. For other people, though, you may see facilities make it much easier to social distance, meaning people might sit 6 feet apart. They might screen people when they come in. They make it very easy to wash your hands. They try and limit personal contact between people in common areas, for example, in bathrooms or common facilities that might be there. So this is something that we can do. We're already seeing countries in Europe start to bring some of this back. So I do think we can do it safely. But I think when you're looking at these arena-style events, it's going to be very, very hard to have those types of things. I can see possibly, so if you're thinking about music concerts, I don't think that you could have a rock concert with a mosh pit, but you might be able to have a Beethoven concert where people are sitting and seated and not spitting and screaming at each other.
Right. So what we were recently told by a doctor who was on a panel put on by many of our professional organizations in conjunction with each other. She was an otolaryngologist and gave the opinion in that meeting that there would be no way to sing for kids to sing together in the same room safely in the next year or 2 years, unless we had a vaccine or a 95% effective treatment. Do you think that's a reasonable statement?
So singing does pose a major problem because when we look at asymptomatic spread, and that's been something that people have been talking about, one of the places where it unequivocally has happened has been in choir practices. And there was a choir practice in Washington that was very famous that happened back in March that really got people attuned to the risk of asymptomatic transmission. So singing is different than talking because you do emanate more particles when you sing. And that is going to be very difficult to do in a way that is safe. I mean, I can imagine ways of doing that by putting up dividers between people. Obviously, it's not so much the issue of infecting children, but is it a question of a children infecting a vulnerable adult? And that has to be something that we'd have to think about. So it might be that if children are going to sing together, that they maybe have some separation between them, as well as if there's somebody, an adult or somebody that's vulnerable that's around them, that they're separated by maybe a plexiglass area if you're going to do that. It just has to be done in a very judicious manner because we know that the asymptomatic transmission can clearly occur in singing. And I would think that there is going to be modifications and there's also going to be a change in risk perception. So I think that's all going to evolve as we learn more about this virus. We're even learning now that even though children can be infected and they have the virus in their nose, it's unclear how much they actually transmit this to adults. So I think that's an important question that we need to answer as we open schools and as we address questions such as the one about children singing in a room together.
Yeah, now that part, the excess particles from singing was also presented in that webinar, and that makes total sense as well. I would imagine there's also some relationship to athletes and sports and close quarter type sports where there's a lot of heavy breathing directly on each other. You know, those types of things. And that would, of course, be hard to build a plexiglass during the middle of a basketball game. But my question would be then how do we then react to that? And yes, it's harder to sing or play sports in close contact when we're in a high risk environment. Then the real operative question would be then how do we decide when we've moved through that period to when those risks are now acceptable again? What metrics should we be using? And this kind of ties again back to my regionality question. Will that be different in some places than others?
One of the things that we can think about doing to make these types of events safer is to have very robust access to testing. So you could imagine testing children that are singing very frequently. They may not like to be tested that frequently, but that might be one way to make it safer. So there are ways that you can think about that. And that's some of the stuff that we're learning in sports is that you can test individuals before and after a game and try and minimize the risk of transmission. Obviously, the risk is not going to be zero. And this is something that we are going to have to think about because the virus is going to be here until we have a vaccine. And there has to be some individual risk tolerance that has to be placed into the mix. And that's going to be different for each person. And it does have some regionality to it in the sense that if the virus is spreading rapidly in a community, obviously there's a higher chance that one of the individuals that you're talking about in a choir or whatever it might be may be infected. If it's not very common and you're doing robust testing of these individuals before you have these events, it's probably less likely that you're going to spread it. So this is something that we have to think about. And the other thing that's important, the metric that I use, again, is hospital capacity. And that's going to be difficult for a lot of other people. I think from a public policy standpoint, hospital capacity has to be the primary issue that we're thinking about. But for the individual and individual risk tolerance, it has to be their own values and what they think is tolerable to them and what they don't think is tolerable to them, because it's not going to be one size fits all. Some people are much more risk averse than others. And it's also going to be the risk tolerance of the people that are putting on the show or whatever it might be, the singing practice in terms of the school, in terms of the club, whatever it might be. What risk do they want to have? And how will they handle that risk? So I do think it's not going to be some black or white answer saying, okay, today it's not safe, today it is safe. That's not going to happen. It's going to be lots of gray, and it's going to involve risk perception over time. And this is something that I think we're going to have a societal discussion about, and there's no clear or easy answers to.
So based on all of the areas that are starting to open up gradually and open up in different ways, allowing different types of activities, do you think that 1 to 2 year timeline, how realistic is that? And in that, I hear that a vaccine, a workable vaccine, might take about that long. But if we're starting to open up and expose each other to this at a much faster rate now that the lockdowns are ending many places, will we get to some kind of either herd immunity slash a big enough percentage have been exposed to the point where we know more about the fatality rate before 1 to 2 years, or is it really going to be a 1 to 2 year wait before we know anything?
No, I do think we're going to learn more about what this virus's inherent characteristics are in terms of what its overall case fatality ratio is, what percentage need to be hospitalized, who are the individuals that are at highest risk, and we'll be able to kind of differentiate between diabetes, hypertension, obesity, all of these risk factors we keep hearing about. We'll definitely learn more about that, and we're learning more about that every day. I don't think, though, that we will get to herd immunity without a vaccine, because this virus is needing to affect about 50 to 60% of the population, and then it's still going to be present and the risk for individuals that that are not vaccinated. So I do think we're likely to see people be infected at very high rates, but I don't know if we'll get to the herd immunity threshold that quickly. I think over a period of 18 months to 2 years, yes, we could maybe get to there, but it's going to be at a major cost. So I do think that even as we move forward and you see states removing some of these restrictions, it's going to be important, especially for those in vulnerable populations, nursing home populations, assisted living, all of those types of people, to really be very cognizant of the risk that they're going to face until we have a vaccine. And we will learn stuff about the case fatality ratio and the hospitalization rate. But the simple fact remains is that in certain populations, this is a very, very deadly disease. If you're above the age of 70, you might, and you need to be hospitalized, your mortality might be 15%. That's not something that we can take lightly. And the fact that we have so many senior citizen centers and we have so many people that have compromising conditions, such as obesity, the majority of the population of the United States is overweight. That can really be a challenge when you're removing social distancing to be able to make sure that you're not going too quickly, because you don't want to inundate a hospital. So again, that's going to go back to regional types of plans, looking at hospital capacity and testing capacity. So I do think that this is going to remain a challenge even as we get more information, because it isn't a benign illness, and this isn't something that is going to go away magically, and it is going to be a challenge that we're going to face for some time.
Absolutely. And I know you're up against the end of your amount of time that you can share with us. So I'm going to have you finish with one more response. There are school board organizations all over the country, regional, statewide, that are starting to come out with prognostications of adjustments to how school should be delivered in the upcoming school year, some ranging from very draconian all the way to not many changes at all. And one of them, near and dear to the coaches and music teachers around the country, and there, I would say, are about 75,000 of us at least, that do these types of, when I say bigger activities, I mean maybe 80 kids in a room versus a typical English class where there's 20, that kind of thing. And one of the recommendations I've seen is the cancellation recommendation is the cancellation of all music, PE, and sports classes for the upcoming school year. unless they can be broken into smaller groups. And so what I guess my question is, I'll put it in my personal world, my biggest class is 85. What do you, in your opinion, would it be a good risk mitigation to the point where that group activity could still happen in the same room if those groups were broken down into, say, two groups of 40 or three groups of 30? Does that change it enough to where that would actually help?
I do think that modifying class sizes by breaking things into smaller groups so that social distancing is easier, so that people can monitor for social distancing, does make things safer. Again, there's a lot of risk perception that's going to be involved here on what risk is tolerable to one school district versus another school district. And there's not going to be an easy answer to all of this. And I think that there's going to be questions that we're going to solve the answer. We're going to solve soon, understanding what the role of children are in the epidemiology, meaning how likely are they to spread this to other individuals. I think those answers are all forthcoming, and that's going to influence how school districts open back up and what activities need to be modified and which ones don't. And I don't think that there's going to be a consensus in my field. I think that there's going to be a lot of differing voices, as there has been throughout this pandemic, because there's not a lot of good data here. And I think what we need to do is actually look at the places right now that have not closed schools, that had some of these activities, and try and decide whether or not that posed an intolerable risk, whether that was a nexus for transmission or whether it wasn't. And I think that's going to help us guide it, but it's not going to be easy. There are going to be many decisions like the one you just raised. And I don't think that we're going to be able to be overly proscriptive. I think it's really going to come down to looking at the data and trying to make the best, give people the best advice we can. And with the caveat that we know nothing is going to be risk-free until we have a vaccine.
Absolutely. That makes a lot of sense. And gathering data from sources rather than guessing what it's going to be ahead of time, I think is probably what we need at this point. Well, I appreciate your time so much, Dr. Adelja, and our education field is in your debt just for helping us become more educated today. And I very much appreciate you coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Thanks a lot. So thank you so much for sticking around to the end of that conversation. I hope you got something out of it. Hopefully even learned something that you didn't know. That's always the goal of a show that's intended to cause us all to think, including yours truly. As I sit here and talk to the guests on this show, I'm always learning something. One of the mottos that you might have heard a lot on this show is that no one person knows everything. And I thought that was a really important point at the end of this episode that Dr. Adelja pointed out as well. Within his own profession, there will be disagreement. One of the things we hear a lot is trust the experts, right? It's almost become a meme. Well, Dr. Adelja is one of the top experts in the world on this topic. But one of the things you heard him point out there is not all of his colleagues agree on all of this stuff. Why? Because the data is not in. We are getting the data now. So my biggest concern in all of this is decisions making what we do for a living really hard to accomplish being made before the data's in. Related to my concern with the NATS and ACDA webinar that was posted a couple days ago, I watched that, and to be honest, guys, I was really frustrated as it was happening that we were presenting a relatively doom and gloom picture with almost no data presented during that webinar, which it had data in the title. I was kind of expecting more data. And I don't want that statement to be interpreted as I have any ill will for ACDA or NATS or any of the other organizations that were involved or for the doctors. But as you just heard Dr. Adelja say, we don't know enough to make a blanket statement from a national organization that will pass down or could potentially have us going to our bosses and shutting down our programs based on one doctor's opinion. And my position on that has been, if a doctor gives you a very serious diagnosis, you trust them that they're an expert. You listen to that and you take it very seriously. But what do? If you're given a death sentence, you go to another doctor and you get more opinions. Not because you think that first doctor was a quack, but because the stakes are so high that you're not going to just place all of your hopes and dreams in what that one doctor thinks. So I reached out to Dr. Adalja to give us another opinion. And as you could hear, there's a little bit more nuance to it than just singing is not safe for the next year or two. There are going to be mitigating factors involved and that are regional and that are different from place to place and different from person to person. And there will have to be some risk assessment for each individual and for each organization. And we knew that going in. What I want to avoid with this episode is as many people as possible accepting that one diagnosis and then causing a blanket shutdown of what we do. Because as I mentioned before, I think we will lose students if we do that, and we will lose them forever. So if that's going to happen, if I'm going to shut down, if I'm going to recommend to my bosses to shut down our program the way it exists, I'm going to have seen data first. I will want to see something other than anecdotal, which is I think what we've mostly have so far. And so my position has been, let's just proceed with a plan A and a plan B. Plan A is that we're able to go back to doing things pretty soon within the next school year the way we're used to doing them, at least in some way, where we can still put kids together in a room and do activities together, okay? Maybe without the fall concert, though, or whatever, right? So there's a plan A. I don't think we can say that plan A is going to be everything's like it was in 2018. That's not going to be part of plan A, right? But there's a plan A that looks pretty good, okay? And then we also prepare, as many of my colleagues or our colleagues immediately jump to do, to what if we can't have choir anymore in the next year or two? What if we really truly cannot have anything that even looks like choir? What do we do? Well, then yes, we should be thinking about that. We should be starting those Facebook groups. We should be having these Zoom lessons or Zoom meetings where we discuss all of these possibilities. But not because we think we're going to actually do it. It's because we want to be prepared. And I think that's my main message, and the message of bringing Dr. Adalja to you today is let's just keep gathering information and proceed slowly and proceed with measured calm and reason. Pointing out to people, yes, we will be prepared because we have ingenuity and we're creative because we're artists. We will come up with new ways to do things if we have to, but if we don't have to, we want to continue to do the things that make kids come to us in the first place. And I think one of the things that really hits my heart the heaviest is if I'm honest with myself, I ask myself how many of my students, if they were told that choir could not be truly choir next year, would not simply walk to the guidance counselor's office on the first day of school and ask for a schedule change. They would ask for that schedule change because choir for them, if for most of our students, I would argue, is a social experience. At least at first, it's a social experience where we might win them over to the intellectual and spiritual and music ideas later, once we've hooked them. But what brings them there is their friends and the large group activity. And if we take that away, many of them will drop out of our classes and go do things that are conducive to small group activities. And that is my worry. So yes, we want to be safe. And yes, we want to not put kids or our communities in danger. But in order to make that decision, we need to be better at risk assessment. And that means we know how to assess risk and be part of those conversations. Because the reality is, these will not be decisions that are made in blanket for everyone. So some of us, like I said, it's just my prediction, we're going to have to be part of the teams that oftentimes that make these decisions. So it's going to be hard, guys. I hope none of you were tuning in planning to get a magic or a silver bullet that will solve this problem. Because as you heard Dr. Adalja said, it's going to be tough. It's going to be really tough and involve a lot of really tough decisions. So I appreciate you listening. And of course, let's keep the conversation going. Like always, you can head over to the Choral Ospers Facebook page and sign on there. It's a private group where we can have conversations about anything that's been on the show or really anything choral related. Plus, you can, if you appreciate the content that is being presented here, you can chip in on Patreon, patreon.com/choralosophy for as little as a coffee a month. $3 gets you in the door over there. And there are behind the scenes episodes. There are once a month for only Patreon members. There are also ways to know ahead of time who I'm interviewing. I will post that ahead of time so that Patreon members will know who's coming and have the opportunity to ask questions. I didn't allow any Patreon questions on this episode because Dr. Adalja had mentioned being very tight for time. As you could possibly imagine, he does rounds at the hospital along with his teaching and think tank work. So he's very, very busy, as you can imagine, during a time like this. So Patreon is an option. Of course, also don't forget about the other sponsors for this show. There's sightreadingfactory.com. There's ryanmain.com and graphitepublishing.com, which are two excellent sheet music online downloadable sheet music vendors that you can use when it's time to sing again, of course. And both of those, all those websites, all three of them have a Chorolosophy checkout code that'll save you 10%. So I appreciate so much this conversation and that you tuned in to listen and stuck with it all the way to the end. I encourage you to subscribe, like, and leave a rating. Help spread the word. I think this conversation is really important, and I can't spread the word all by myself. The Facebook algorithm won't, and the Twitter algorithm won't let me. So the only way that lots of people will see and hear this conversation is if you spread it around. So please consider doing that. It's probably the biggest thing you could do to help. Thanks so much, and we'll see you next time.